You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. How noisy is natural gas development? Well, it depends on what you're hearing, whether it's drilling, fracking, or processing gas. This summer, state regulators are trying to get a handle on one of the most persistently noisy places, compressor stations. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, these sites are necessary to process and transport gas through pipelines.
Shale gas development is a noisy business. Companies start by drilling wells with a big rig. There's a lot of trucks and heavy equipment. Next, millions of gallons of water are pumped in for the fracking phase to release the gas and get the well into production. But once the well is producing gas, things quiet down. The people and equipment are gone. It's basically just a bunch of pipes in the ground. There isn't much to see or hear at this one, operated by Seneca Resources in the Loyal Sock State Forest in north central Pennsylvania.
Natural sound, natural gas.
That's Seneca spokesman Rob Boulware. His company is one of the biggest operators in the state forest system. Although things are quiet here, there's another place that can remain noisy for years, even decades. Seneca's Hagerman Compressor Station in the Loyal Sock Forest came online last fall. It's capable of processing up to 400 million cubic feet of gas per day. Compressor stations are needed to keep the gas flowing. Each unit looks sort of like a large shed with a giant fan on the end. There are legitimate issues with how they affect air quality, but the sites are also a significant source of noise pollution. The engines hum constantly, pulling gas out of the wells and pushing it through pipelines. Ian Vranich is a manager with the company's midstream operations. He oversees sites like this one. He explains that each compressor unit has its own separate building with 8 to 10 inches of insulation.
Whenever the engine's running, we try to keep everything as contained to keep the noise contained inside the building, so we're not, you know, passing that noise out into the open air environment.
The State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, which manages public forest land, is trying to get a better handle on this constant source of noise, which can disturb people and wildlife. Right now, compressor stations on state forest land can't exceed 55 decibels at 300 feet from the site. But the agency's working with Penn State University acoustics professor Tom Gabrielson to reconsider those rules.
300 feet is an arbitrary distance. Is that really the point at which the annoyance should be measured in the state forest? And if the nearest hiking trail is 1,000 feet from the station, then a reference point of 300 feet doesn't make much sense.
There are only about a dozen compressor station sites on state forest land right now, but the department predicts up to 200 could eventually be built. As Gabrielson explains, the decibel level only measures loudness, but there are many other factors that affect how noise is perceived, from frequency to the topography of the area, even the weather and the wind speed on a particular day. He plays 4 different sounds, all at the same average decibel level, but points out they're widely different in terms of annoyance. He starts with rain and thunder. Then a helicopter flying overhead. Dogs barking. And birds chirping.
Some of those I could sleep through easily. Some of them would wake me up.
Paul Karpich is one of those people who gets woken up. He lives in Susquehanna County in northeastern Pennsylvania, one of the most productive areas of the Marcellus Shale. His home is within 2 miles of 3 different compressor stations. The closest one is about 3,000 feet away.
You lay in bed, you can hear this thing running. Sounds like there's a truck in the driveway, now 30 feet away.
In an effort to single out the most irritating parts of the noise, Penn State professor Tom Gabrielson set up microphones that recorded for 2 weeks around a compressor station in the Tyodotten Forest in the north-central part of the state. He's still crunching the data, but hopes to help regulators craft more nuanced guidelines for the industry.
So we have a really good measurement set for the noise from one particular compressor station. And it's sort of the start of a study. It's hopefully a beginning.
But the rules would only apply to the state forest system. And as Pennsylvania's gas production keeps breaking new records, companies are building more and more compressor stations, and most of them aren't in state forest. Noise regulations can vary by county. Although federal regulations exist for compressor sites on interstate pipelines, there's currently no statewide sound standard. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Dominion Resources Incorporated hopes to build a pipeline to transport natural gas from the Marcellus Shale Formation to Virginia and North Carolina. The proposed Southeast Reliability Project would start in Harrison County and travel through Lewis, Upshur, Randolph, and Pocahontas counties in West Virginia. Allegheny Mountain Radio's Megan Moriarty reports that the company recently presented Pocahontas County with some details on the possible project.
On August 19th, Dominion Resources Representative Robert Orndorff spoke at the Pocahontas County Commission meeting, briefing commissioners on the current details of their 550-mile natural gas pipeline project. He said the company has sent survey notifications to landowners within a 400-foot study corridor. The pipeline could cross 12 miles in Pocahontas County, covering 29 tracts of land, with the Monongahela National Forest being the largest tract holder.
With the increased development of the Marcellus and Utica, there's an overabundance of natural gas in north central West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Natural gas right now is the target of a lot of opportunity to generate electricity.
The proposed pipeline would consist of two lines, one bringing natural gas to North Carolina and a lateral line delivering natural gas to Hampton Roads on the Virginia coast. The pipeline itself is proposed to be 42 inches in diameter in West Virginia and Virginia. In North Carolina, it would be 36 inches, and the Hampton Roads pipeline would be 20 inches in diameter. If constructed, the capacity of this pipeline is projected to be 1.5 billion cubic feet per day. Right now, Orndorff says Dominion is still in the surveying phase.
As we do investigations on this pipeline, We seek permission first before we step foot on anyone's property. We don't have to do that in West Virginia, but we choose to do that. We choose to do the right thing. If somebody does not give us permission to be on their property, we will not go on that property. And at some point in time, we have to be on that property. We will try to find a way to work with that landowner to be on that property.
So far, the company has had two meetings with the Monongahela National Forest staff. Dominion is continuing to meet with them, working through what Orndorff called the corridor issue.
Some point in time, we will have to list where we plan to cross the Mon Forest in our final. We're not at that point yet now, and that's why we haven't surveyed in Pocahontas County.
According to Orndorff, the Southeast Reliability Project would be a transport pipeline, which means Pocahontas County and several others along the pipeline wouldn't have access to the natural gas. He also said the county would see a tremendous amount of business while work crews would be in the area during the construction phase, but project supervisor Greg Park said the jobs would likely be given to unionized workers.
Typically, this is a job of this size, a project this size, and more likely this would be a union project, be a union contractor. They're required by the contract with the negotiations to that they can only bring in 50%, like from different states. And then the other 50% is out of the local union halls.
The county commission brought up the point that a 42-inch pipeline has never been built in a place like Pocahontas County, with mountainous terrain and frequent elevation changes. Orndorff indicated that a project of such magnitude in this area would be a risk.
Obviously, the larger the pipeline, the heavier the pipeline, the heavier the pipe, and the harder it is to build. We understand that that's a risk that we take. But to serve this market, that's what the size of that's the capacity that the market is asking for us to deliver to. So we understand that this is not going to be an easy process.
According to Orndorff, Dominion will submit a pre-filing application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also known as FERC, at some point in time fairly soon. Dominion could receive a FERC certificate in the summer of 2016, with construction taking place from 2017 to 2018. For Allegheny Mountain Radio, this is Megan Moriarty.
The director of the Kentucky Resources Council says politicians who imply that a change of presidents or congressional leaderships will spark a revival of eastern Kentucky's coal industry are not helping region's people. Tom Fitzgerald made the comment Monday on KET's Kentucky Tonight. He says the loss of 7,000 coal mining jobs in the area in recent years has little to do with President Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency. Fitzgerald says cheaper alternatives like shale gas and high sulfur coal from western Kentucky are mostly responsible.
For the person who's out of work in eastern Kentucky who had a mining job, it wasn't EPA's withholding permits. Fully permitted operations were shutting down. It is all about the shale gas and all about the regulatory drivers that are causing natural gas to look better.
Fitzgerald says highly skilled coal miners can be retrained to do many other jobs, and policies promoting that would be more beneficial to those workers and the region. Still to come, meet a woman that's been referred to as one of the toughest women in America from, you guessed it, Appalachia. This is Inside Appalachia. Your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A former coal miner who in the 1990s helped fight the first major case against mountaintop removal mining died last Friday. James, or Jimmy Weekly, of Blair, West Virginia, was 74 years old. He lived in Pigeon Roost Hollow, the community at the base of Blair Mountain, all his life. He worked as a coal miner, as did his grandfather, father, uncles, and sons. And like most West Virginians, Weekly saw coal as the economic lifeblood of his community. Then, in the 1990s, Arch Coal moved into his area and began work on the Spruce No. 1 mine. It was one of the largest mountaintop removal mining sites ever proposed, and it was virtually in Weekly's backyard. Almost overnight, he was transformed into an unlikely anti-mining activist. Over the years, he watched as his family and friends decided to leave Pigeon Roost Hollow. 3 years ago, Joe Richmond and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries visited Weekly and produced this story of the last man on the mountain.
My name is James Weekly. I'm standing on the porch in front of my house here in Pigeon Roost Hollow. In West Virginia. You can probably hear the string in the background. I'm 71, and I've lived in this hollow of these here all my life. When I was a kid, there was 27 homes in this hollow. My mom and dad lived up the road right here, about 100 feet from here. My first cousin lived right over here. Back down this way, Van Curry and Cecilia Burgess, but right now, no one else lives in this hollow except me, James Weekly, me, and the coal company.
For the last 3.5 years, the top of Blair Mountain has been dug and blasted away. The growth of mountaintop removal has pushed mines close to communities. The coal industry says it is carving away mountaintops and filling valleys with care and precision. But many here worry that there will be a price for permanently altering the landscape.
My name is Joe Lovett. Jimmy and his wife, Sibby, walked into my office in late 1997. I had just become a lawyer. They were my very first clients, actually. And Jimmy had an article about mountaintop removal with him. It was a huge two-page picture, and he pointed to it. You know, there's just destruction all over the picture. He said, I live right there.
The wife and I couldn't sit on the porch for the dust. And the noise, constant, blasting, tearing my home all to hell. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Well, next thing I know, my friends was starting to sell. The coal company come in and offered them $70,000, $80,000, and $90,000. They thought that was big bucks. I started going out and talking to these people. I said, hey, please don't sell. This is your roots. You've been here all your life. Hold in there. We can beat this thing. But they all sold out to the coal company.
So Jimmy was the only thing standing between Arch Coal and probably some of the best reserves left in this state. There's no question that they could have sold that land for a lot of money. But he and Sibby stood up to a mining company in a way really that no one had before and said, we're not leaving here and you can't make us.
James Wheatley stands in the way of a planned 3,100-acre expansion by Arch Coal of St. Louis, Missouri. What Wheatley sees as his land, his heritage for his grandchildren, the coal industry sees as buried treasure. Arch Coal can move mountains, but it can't move James Wheatley.
My name is Bill Rainey, and I'm president of the West Virginia Coal Association. The good Lord put the resources in these mountains, and of course, it's a huge, huge part of the state's economy, coal in West Virginia. Most everyone have relatives that have something to do with the mining industry. They want to sustain their family. They want a good job. And they're proud of what they do. So Mr. Wheatley became the center of a lot of attention.
Look at me. I'm your neighbor that you put out of work.
We want jobs today. We don't want our families leaving, going to the Carolinas.
Nearing his coal field home, James Wheatley got an unfriendly, screaming, egg-throwing reception.
I'm not out here to take their jobs. I'm out here trying to make a long-term future for my grandchildren, their grandchildren, and everyone else.
Well, do you understand why they're frustrated with you
no,
in particular?
No, not particularly. I do not know.
Mr. Wheatley, for whatever reason, did not sell 12 years on. He remains where he was, and others have moved on.
I'm in my car, a Lincoln Continental Town Car. We're on Route 17 going north, and we're going to pick up some cigarettes. I smoke. This is the town of Blair, West Virginia. There was about 450 homes in here 10, 15 years ago. But look at it now. 30 homes. 30 homes at the most. Virginia Grimes lives right here. That's one of the people who won't talk to me. The boys worked over and got laid off. They had to go somewhere else to get a job. They put the blame on Sibby and I. And they ain't spoke to me since.
Yes, ma'am?
Give me 5 Winston lights. Thank you, my dear. Hello, Tim. That man right there worked on a mountaintop removal.
Yeah.
This is Timmy Dotson. Tell me your name.
My name's Tim Dotson. I'm from Blair, West Virginia. The last most tranquil place on the earth. Now it ain't even on the map anymore. You go buy a new map today, that town ain't on there.
How come?
Mountaintop removal and coal mine. Coal itself.
Did it create jobs?
That's funny. I helped build that coal mine up there. I helped tear the old one down, build the new one, and still can't get a job.
Well, Timmy, do you think that I'm doing the right thing by fighting mountaintop removal? I want the truth. Are you against me?
Well, for it and against it. You know what I mean? It don't matter, Jimmy. Yeah. You ain't going to stop it.
But if we can put a slowdown to it.
It ain't going to happen.
Oh, I have.
Yeah. I can honestly say you slowed it down a time or two.
Yeah.
But you're not going to stop progress,
what?
Buddy.
Wouldn't you rather
as long as there's coal here, they're going to get it one way or another. On top, underground. They have to have it. Okay? You ain't going to stop it.
Thank you very much, Tammy.
Yeah, not a problem, Don. Be careful.
Ooh. Blasting area. Trespassers will be prosecuted. This is the Spruce Number 1 mine in Pigeon Roost Holler, right in my backyard. We're looking where they have shot the top of the mountain off to get down to the coal. And that's the way they do it. They just keep the blasting the top off from it. Until this mountain in here, all the way around, is just level. Every bit of this will be level. My great-great-grandpa was the one that owned all this. They come here in 1834, and they settled in Pigeon Roost. He owned this, as far as the eye could see in here. And we called it our mountain. There ain't a place on these mountains that we haven't left our footprints. Oh, baby. Thank you for coming over. This is my granddaughter, Alicia Dawn Weekly.
Favorite granddaughter, right?
I love them all. Last count I had was 29.
29
grandchildren. And I think three more's are coming, what I can find out. So I'd make 32.
That's a lot of kids, ain't it? You and Granny built this house, didn't you, Poppy? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did, baby. Mama put a lot of nails in this house. Sibby was Weekly. We was together almost 48 years. I miss her. What do you think about Papa quitting this mountaintop removal and going on with his life?
Papa, you're not selling, right?
I don't know.
Do you really want to be truthful?
Yeah.
Poppy, I know you get lonely, but I think I would literally cry if you sold. This is where we all grew up. This is where we played. We love it here.
Well, you kids, you don't know what Poppy goes through, living by myself. No one to talk to, day in and day out, looking at the pictures my wife has put up on the wall. I get lonesome. It just takes my heart out of me.
So if Granny was still here, you'd never sell,
I'd
right?
I'd never sell. I'd never sell. There ain't no doubt in my mind.
And you're just lonely.
Yes. I'll be truthful with you, baby. Yes.
You know, it's hard, Poppy. I want you to be happy. I do. I can't blame you. It's just, I don't think you should let them have your house for anything.
Well, I got a big decision to make. Will James Weekly finally give in to the coal company?
Poppy.
Yes, baby.
It was good talking to you. I love you.
I love you too, baby.
Bye. Bye. Y'all have a good night and have a safe trip back. Love you. Take care.
I was born here in Pigeon Roost, Holland. I've never been out west, California, Montana. I've never been to them places. But I've always wanted to go on up and see the aspen trees up in Maine. I always did want to go up there and look at them. And then take a plane and go across the waters to the Philippine Islands, all of them, visit them. I'd like to go to Paris, London. Just travel the rest of my life, enjoy myself. This is what I'm liking to do. But I'd still have Pigeon Roost Holler on my mind no matter where I went. It's hard to get out of a place where you've lived all your life. The old saying is, you always want to come back where your roots are. And I'm just not ready.
This story about Jimmy Weekly was produced 3 years ago by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark for Radio Diaries. Jimmy died last week at 74. A longer version of the story can be heard on the Radio Diaries podcast at radiodiaries.org. And there's news this week about Blair Mountain. A federal appeals court says environmental groups can challenge the removal of the site from the National Register of Historic Places. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ruled recently that the groups have legal standings to bring the challenge. In 2012, U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton dismissed the lawsuit filed by the Sierra Club and other groups against the U.S. Department of Interior. The lawsuit sought to prevent mining on Blair Mountain. Walton ruled that the groups had no standing to bring the challenge. The appeals court sent the case back to the lower court for further proceedings. 30 West Virginians were killed as a result of domestic violence in just a year's time during the last reporting period between October 2012 and September 2013. That's according to the West Virginia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. It's a situation that Wyoming County native Christy Salters Martin is all too familiar with. The six-time World Boxing Council champion found herself fighting for her life after her former husband and manager tried to kill her. The former boxer is now sharing her story with the hopes of helping other victims.
When I was born to coal miner's daughter,
Christy Salters was born a coal miner's daughter. She grew up in Itmann, a coal camp town in Wyoming County just outside of Mullins. She went to Concord University while it was still a college. She fought in several amateur boxing matches and went on to win a few professional fights in Tennessee. In 1993, she signed with flashy boxing promoter Don King.
For a female fighter from small town in southern West Virginia to be sitting across the table from King negotiating a contract, it was pretty overwhelming.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of the top women's pound-for-pound boxers, known as the coal miner's daughter, introducing Christy Martin.
But through all that success, Christy was hiding the fact that she was a lesbian. She married her manager, Jim Martin, even though she saw him as a friend.
I lived a lie for 20 years, very much behind closed doors. It was hell in front of the camera. Lots of people thought I had it made, and, you know, like it was heaven on earth for me, which I was fortunate. I had lots of things, but I wasn't happy.
The couple lived in Florida, and although living a lie, Salter says she was honest with Martin. She told him she had relationships with women. Salter says Martin held that over her head and threatened to blackmail her.
And there was never that perfect time to leave, because as my boxing career got bigger, then my stakes were higher. Like, he would say, I'll tell Don King, I'll go to the media. Everybody will know you're a lesbian, and then, people aren't going to like you. They don't like you anyway. And I believed him.
Salter says Martin was controlling and verbally abusive, but she knew that the majority of the domestic violence deaths happen when the victims try to leave. Salters stuck it out until she reached such a low point that she didn't care what happened. She finally left, and on November 23rd, 2010, Martin attacked her.
I had to live through whatever it was he was going to dish out. Either I had to live through it or I was going to die. I mean, it really, truly did not matter to me until about halfway through the attack. And I was like, you know what? I told him, you cannot kill me.
Martin had already stabbed and pistol-whipped her, and once again, her fighting spirit was back.
He kept waiting for me to die, and when he saw I wasn't going to die, he shot me. But I just prayed harder, and God answered my prayers, and I heard the water turn on in the shower, and when the shower turned on, I was able to escape the house and flag down a neighbor, actually, and he took me to the emergency room. They had to life flight me out, but here I am, hopefully telling my story to help someone else. I mean, God had to let me live for a reason.
Martin shot her with her own pink 9mm. The bullet missed her heart by about 2 inches. Martin was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Salters is sharing her story to help others in domestic violence situations. After all, if it could happen to a world boxing champion, she says, it could happen to anyone.
Hopefully I'm touching somebody else. And if that's why I had to go through what I did to help save some other people, then that's okay with me. It's okay, because I made it. And so many people don't.
Salters moved back to Itmann in February of this year, but expects to move back to Charlotte, North Carolina with her partner, Sherry Lusk, after a few events in West Virginia to raise money and awareness about domestic violence. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. More than 50 years of marriage, plus two international performing careers, plus a shared passion for seeking out eclectic and interesting objects, adds up to one remarkable collection. World-famous opera singer Frances Yend and her husband amassed just such a collection. As Sarah Lowther Hensley reports, the items are going on the auction block at the Sagebrush Roundup near Fairmont.
Frances Yend spent her twilight years in Morgantown, but earlier her strong soprano voice graced stages in major concert halls around the nation and the world during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Her husband, James Benner, also traveled far and wide as an accomplished accompanist and voice coach. In a 2002 interview for West Virginia Public Television's series Aging with Grace and Dignity, Yend expressed her love for world travel.
I loved going places. I've always loved going in different places in the world. Italy and France, Germany, all those places. I've been to all the different ones, and I've enjoyed them very, very much.
During their travels, she and her husband began to amass an incredible collection of antiques and books. In the late 60s, they gave up living out of suitcases and left New York City to join the music faculty at West Virginia University. Their collection came with them to Morgantown and continued to grow. Yend passed away in 2008, and Benner, faced with some health issues, is downsizing into a small apartment. The time has come, he says, to sell the collection.
I've tried to make my mindset as rigid about getting rid of things as I was about collecting them back when I was collecting them in my pack rat stages, so to speak. But it's a big emotional upheaval to get rid of all these things which we both loved so much and collected over so many years. And it's hard to suddenly say it's all going to go.
Benner says his relatives live far away. They've had the chance to come and select the things they would like to have, but he didn't want his family to have to figure out what to do with the rest of it later. Enter West Virginia auctioneer Joe Pyle, stage left, wearing his trademark cowboy hat. Yend and Benner attended many of Pyle's auctions over the years. He said they were among his best customers. Now his role is to survey the contents of their entire home and prepare the collection for sale.
When you look at the inventory of this house, I mean, they've been into lithographs, they've been into glassware, Staffordshire, Persian rugs, Asian, ivory, Renaissance furniture, paintings, unbelievable library books.
He and his crew have been working behind the scenes for months. They've spent lots of time with Benner, who says he's been happy to talk about the items he loves.
I often do remember the particular circumstances of a purchase, especially if it's a major purchase, because you think a lot before you decide to spend the money on something. And we didn't usually buy things with an idea that it was a good purchase market-wise or anything like that. We bought things that we loved.
Quirky items sometimes caught their eye.
One of the most unusual things that's in the sale is a Buddhist manuscript, which is opens like an accordion, kind of. It's almost a foot long, or 3 feet long. And I remember seeing that in a shop in California and thinking every household needs one.
Pyle says there won't be another auction like this around for many, many years.
It'll be fun to watch, and there's something there for everybody. I mean, there will be items that sell for $20. There will be items that sell for $30,000.
So, the stage is set. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sarah Lowther Hensley in Fairmont. Southwestern Pennsylvania's famous Frank Lloyd Wright home, Falling Water, will be featured in a new PBS program called 10 Homes That Changed America. The crew out of Chicago started production there last week. Glennis Board of West Virginia Public Radio paid a visit.
So we're at Falling Water on something called The Bridge.
Dan Protas is the PBS program's producer. He says when he and his crew arrived at Falling Water, it was like being introduced to a movie star.
We spend like weeks and weeks and weeks reading every single book we can get our hands on about Falling Water. And then you, having done all this research, you show up and it's like, wow, there it is.
Protas put together a panel of advisors from academia to help decide which homes would be featured on the show.
Part of our goal here is to start a conversation about architecture. We're not trying to be the final word.
Falling Water was a natural choice since Frank Lloyd Wright is one of America's most famous architects. The show's host, Jeffrey Baer, says when Wright built the house in 1937, he blew up certain ideas about modern architecture.
You know, this house could not be anywhere but here.
Wright got the commission to design the 7,000-square-foot estate from Edgar Kaufman, president of Kaufman's Department Store. The Pittsburgh businessman brought Wright to his rural retreat in southwestern Pennsylvania, pointing out the waterfall as his favorite feature. Show host Jeffrey Baer says Kaufman expected the house to have a good view of the falls.
Wright put the house on top of the waterfall, and he said that his reasoning was that if you just sat there and looked at the waterfall all day long, you'd get tired of it. You should be part of the waterfall.
Stone floors are waxed, so they look like the wet stream bed beneath the house. The walls are made from rock quarried from the area. Stairways bend and wrap around corners, and some lead right into a spring or terminate hovering above the stream bed. Wright called it organic architecture. He coined the phrase when he wrote these words in 1936.
So here I stand before you preaching organic architecture, declaring organic architecture to be the modern ideal and the teaching so much needed if we are to see the whole of life and to now serve the whole of life, holding no traditions essential to the great tradition.
The Kaufman family donated Falling Water to the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy in 1963. The organization opened it to the public and has maintained it ever since. PBS program host Baer says there are good reasons why 4.5 million people have toured the home over the last 50 years.
It is earthed into this rock on the hillside and perilously projecting out over a waterfall. And everything about the house refers to the site when you're outside of it. And then when you go inside, you still feel like you're outside.
Andy says there's no escaping the sounds and smells of Falling Water.
Anywhere you are in the house, you can hear it. You can smell the forest and the wet stone and the wood. There's a full sensory experience in the house. It's pretty amazing.
Baer says it'll be a challenge to compress the story of the house into a 5-minute segment for their program. 10 Homes That Changed America is slated to be broadcast in 2016. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board at Falling Water.
So you might have heard of bird watching, but what about frog watching? That story coming up. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A nonprofit in Charleston is using urban farming to accomplish two goals. The Charleston Area Alliance has a program called SAGE that's helping to revive a neighborhood on the city's west side, while also teaching a new generation of farmers to thrive as business entrepreneurs. Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
On a sultry summer evening, three women are killing harlequin beetles in an effort to save the greens at the Sage Micro Farm on Rebecca Street that they landscaped themselves. Last year, they completed 18 agriculture and business classes through SAGE. The acronym stands for Sustainable Agricultural Entrepreneurs. Grower Kathy Moore says she loves getting to take home an unlimited supply of fresh vegetables each week.
Oh my goodness, the green zebra tomatoes were absolutely my favorite. They're just luscious.
Kathy and most of the other growers have income they earn outside of the SAGE program. They also earn a few $100s apiece at the end of the year based on the group's produce sales. The food is grown on Charleston's west side in a high-crime area with many vacant lots. Over the past 2 years, the SAGE program has transformed two of these lots into working micro farms. New this year is the Rebecca Street Garden, with its unusual swirling starburst shape. At the center of the beds of squash, kale, and tomatoes is a bright circle of sunflowers, zinnias, basil, and cilantro. Kathy was surprised that the garden's design has done so well.
I had no idea that it would be so inviting. So, yeah, it is. It's a really nice design, and people are excited just to come and look at it, and they're amazed the first time that they come.
The SAGE program teaches growers like Meg Reichman how to make a business plan and how to choose the most profitable types of produce.
I was having a difficult time sitting down and figuring out what my break-even price was and whether it was worth growing or not to go through and make a plan.
Many of the students struggle with these questions, says SAGE instructor Dee Singnights with West Virginia University's Extension Services.
When they really started to put their cost and all their expenses down on paper and their eyes were just getting bigger and bigger, really, this is what it actually took? You know, so and I think it's an eye-opening experience for anybody.
Dee also tells the growers to make sure the public knows. SAGE's organic produce might cost a little more than supermarket vegetables, which often come from larger, more mechanized farms.
I always tell them, you have to tell your customers that, listen, the reason why this costs more is I squash my bugs by hand.
That kind of public education goes on each Saturday at the SAGE produce booth at Charleston's East End Bazaar. Customer Louisa Swift peers at the vegetables for sale through round turquoise glasses.
13 even.
She says the prices are pretty similar to what she pays at Kroger. And she's willing to pay a little more for unique items, like purple beans and heirloom tomatoes, that Kroger doesn't have.
I really appreciate the efforts that this particular group of farmers is making because it has enlarged the type of vegetables that we have in the area.
Another one of SAGE's customers is the Bluegrass Kitchen, just a block away from the East End Bazaar. The restaurant chef, Justin Steele, says he makes every effort to adapt his weekly specials just so he can use SAGE produce.
Even if it is a little more because it's grown, you know, by hand, by people we know, like we're willing to pay a little extra for it. I get occasionally patty pan squash from Meg, and we'll stuff that with like a farro pilaf and roast it and serve that, you know, as a vegetarian option.
The SAGE growers are learning to educate more potential customers about the value of spending more money inside the community versus sending the money out of state by buying food at a chain store. Even if the 18 SAGE graduates never become full-time farmers, this morning for breakfast they are probably all making food using at least one ingredient they grew themselves. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
If you're interested in birds, you've probably heard of the Christmas Bird Count. On December 25th, volunteers head out to see what feathered friends are in their area and report to a national databank. You may not know that a similar enterprise is underway for frogs. In fact, the North American Amphibian Monitoring Project is looking for help in Virginia, as Sandy Hausman reports.
Brian Munford is an executive chef who loves nature, but when his workday ends at around 10 p.m., bird watching is out of the question. That's why he jumped at the chance to join the North American Amphibian Monitoring Project. At least three times a year, he drives a rural route, stopping near wetlands to listen for frogs.
I thought it'd be neat to check out a couple of these spots because they should be wet, and they're far enough away from any kind of rural agricultural activity that they should be relatively pristine. So, we'll see what we see.
Hear what we hear.
It took a couple of years to learn the sounds that 27 native frogs make in this part of the world. At the state's Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, herpetologist J.D. Klepfer says there are mating calls, distress calls, and release calls.
Some of these frogs get into very amorous group breeding events. And so anything that moves, a male frog will try to jump on it. If he happens to jump onto another male frog, that male frog will give a release call to say, hey, I'm a guy, you know, get off me.
Munford listened to recordings in his spare time and found ways to associate each call with a familiar sound.
Everything from banjo strings to 80s pop songs.
80s pop songs?
I think that the green frog, when it starts to call, sounds just like the beginning of Modern Love, the David Bowie song.
Some frogs are increasingly hard to find, but Munford says others are turning up in new places.
The green tree frog is definitely expanding. The wood frog, which is typically a mountain species, is actually moving down into the coastal plain. And just this summer, I found the barking tree frog 40 miles west of its previous known occurrence.
In one spot off old Highway 40 near the southeast corner of the state, at least four kinds of frogs are calling. Munford watches fireflies flashing in the trees as he listens to this soundtrack, and he keeps an eye out for raccoons, deer, owls, skunks, and possums. He rarely meets people during his rounds. Tonight, however, a concerned citizen in a pickup truck stops to inquire.
You all right?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, okay. All righty.
I'll never forget, I think it was the second time I went out on my route, a Suffolk police officer stopped to ask me what I was up to. And I told him, and he told me to rock on.
And he felt like a rock star when he came across what may be a new species of frog, one also observed by state frog expert J.D. Klepfer.
It sounded like wood frogs, but I'm like, it's way outside the range of wood frogs, and it's way too early for green tree frogs, which also sound a little bit alike. Then I went to a meeting shortly thereafter and ran into a researcher out of Rutgers that has just recently described a new species of leopard frog. And as soon as I described the quacking-like sound, his eyes just opened up and he said, that's the new species of frog.
The high-pitched calls are chorus frogs, but there's also a clucking sound. And that's what has Klepfer, Munford, and their colleague at Rutgers excited. They've been taking genetic samples from those as-yet-unnamed frogs to confirm their finding, and they invite others to join their search to help state scientists determine how frogs are doing here in Virginia and how planners can regulate development, farming, and other land use to assure that frogs have a clean, healthy place to perform. I'm Sandy Houseman.
I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.